Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cat. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like,
you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it." So he said, "Man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison." And I said, "What are we going to do?" So he said, "Hold on, man. Let me get some lawyers." So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, "Man, we got a major problem." He said, "I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year." We took the first year and we sent it in. He said, "Man, well, this is an old tax return." He said, "Man, we got a problem." He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was, my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, "Nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses." And I heard a guy on the phone say, "What are we going to do when he goes to jail?" And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, "Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem." When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, "Steve, what you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to go to work."
I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming. Sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
Karnataka, southwest India, a land of temples, lush forests, but little electricity. With over 18,000 families lacking access to the grid, when the sun goes down, vast swathes of the region are shrouded in darkness. Solar energy has the potential to bring light to every home.
The people living in these areas are never going to have access to electricity. The only option for them to ever access power would be to use solar energy.
Set up 10 years ago, Selco Solar Energy is now working across the state, providing reliable and affordable energy to over 40,000 families. Selco's team of local technicians from Udupi are loading up a system to head off into the forest. Today they're making a round trip to the Belsangadi region to bring light into the lives of another family. When they arrive, the technicians get straight to work, opening up the roof and finding the best spot for the solar panel.
Whenever we bring a solar system to a new site, we first select where to mount the panel. There are several restrictions. It must be south-facing and shadow-free. Then we consult with the customer where to keep the battery and where to install the lights.
This installation will power 4 lights. The solar panels produce a 12-volt, 40-watt charge, which is connected to a 60-amp-hour lead-acid battery, giving each light 4 hours life per day. A charge regulator is installed to help recharge the battery. After just 2 hours, the system is up and running, much to the delight of the proud new owners.
We're very happy with the new light. The children can now read with it, so we're very pleased.
The word is spreading. At this women's group, they're discussing the new technology. Selco's dealer explains how the system works and how to pay. There are over 5,000 self-help groups like this across Karnataka, with women clubbing together to take out small loans. Costing roughly $400 per unit, it's crucial that financing is thought through carefully.
As a group, this group has a greater chance of accessing bank funds because the bank also finds a greater security in the group borrowing because there is peer pressure to return the money back and ensure that the payments are done in time.
The meeting is being held at the home of Geeta Koragappa, who bought her system a year ago. She saves money by not having to buy kerosene and having time to work in the evenings.
After installing the solar light, I can save 40 or 50 rupees a month, which I use to pay for the loan for the system.
Another crucial factor is aftercare. Selco has a network of service centres where staff provide technical support to customers. Each centre has strict monthly targets and uses local agents.
The traditional problem with solar energy was systems were supplied in the areas and then it was not followed up with support. So what we have done is we have created these localized service centers within a distance of 100 to 150 kilometers from the customer's place, and these centers provide service to the individual customer.
Each service center has at least two technicians who tour the region and visit each installation every 3 months to service the system and make sure they're being used properly.
This system was installed 6 months ago, so it's scheduled for another service. First, we clean dust and bird droppings off the solar panel, then check float levels on the battery and top it up if needed. Then we clean the terminals and smear on Vaseline, check the current and the connections, and finally clean any insects off the lights.
Bringing light to the region has also brought benefit to local traders. These street hawkers in Bundapur are all using solar power. They're members of a light cooperative project started by a local NGO in partnership with Selco and run by local entrepreneurs. There are now over 70 stores here using solar light, and the scheme has been replicated in 13 places across the state.
Every morning, the batteries are charged using solar panels. So I take the batteries that are fully charged and come and meet the hawkers every evening at 4:30. They give me a 12 rupee fee, then they discharge the batteries in the evening, and I charge them all up again the next day. And so it goes on every day.
In recognition of the project's success and its contribution to sustainable development, Selco have been shortlisted for an Ashton Award. They now hope to reach the poorest sections of the community.
We intend to use the Ashton Award to create income generation activities to pay back the bank loans and make solar systems viable for them.
With over 46% of homes in India off the grid and many more with unreliable electricity, Selco is hoping to replicate the success of Karnataka across India.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, and Peach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Louisville, Nashville, Knoxville, Ombabaka, Shepherdville, Jacksonville, Waterville, Coastal, Rifle, Pittsfield, Springfield, Bakersfield, Shreveport, Hackensack, Cadillac, Fond du Lac, Davenport, Idaho, Jellicoe, Argentina, Diamantina, Pasadena, Catalina, Sea, Guatemala. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Pittsburgh, Parkersburg, Gravelburg, Colorado, Ellensburg, Rexburg, Vicksburg, Eldorado, Larimore, Atmore, Havistraw, Chattanooga, Chasta, Nebraska, Alaska, Opelika, Baraboo, Waterloo, Kalamazoo, Kansas City, Sioux City, Cedar City, Dodge City, what a pity. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been
everywhere. One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the black female in three areas. First, the black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the black woman's demise. She raised the black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the black race, outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race," end quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities, and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking against lynchings, and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919, was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America, and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturists and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company, in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, "Since 1911," placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.
A man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, bless my soul, you load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't no high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Former number one record way, way, way back in the day by Tennessee Ernie Ford. Anyway, today's podcast is titled The Problem versus the Promise. And all these podcasts are tied into what we're doing offline with building. But we're going to get into the problem, the philosophy here, the problem versus the promise, which I think everybody will come across. So I'm going to replay Steve Harvey, his $22 million tax problem, because some of us might not have that big of a tax problem, but we might come across situations in life that, whether it might be $200, $2,000, $200,000, or $22 million, you don't know how to solve it. So we're going to play Steve Harvey, then we're going to dissect again how he solved that problem using the philosophy of what I call the problem versus the promise.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died,
And a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see
600,000
yeah,
you look at deducted.
That account, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was, my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
No. Oh. Wait a minute.
All right, four takeaways I get from that is, and there's a lot there. But and let's go from a scriptural basis. Now, that scripture could be in various holy books, Old Testament, New Testament, the Jewish Torah, which is basically the first, you know, the first, I think, five books of the Old Testament. Then different religions have their own scripts or whatever, but or something that you read in some self-help and motivational book, but focus on the promise instead of the problem. So I think Steve, he didn't get bogged down on what could happen to him negatively. He didn't participate in any toxic thoughts, just like he was on that conversation, and he, you know, those, they didn't know how, you know what they put, because a lot of people, they place themselves, what would they do? Obviously, the people who presented that plan to him that he had to follow, they didn't know how to get through it. So that's why they said what they said. What will we do after he goes to jail? All right. Steve didn't think that way. Steve, whatever philosophy that he held on to, that helped him, gave him what he needed to do. Number two, behind every problem, there is a solution. Now, a lot of people just look at the problem and get paralyzed into doing anything, doing nothing, because they just look at their problem. But every problem has a solution, or in many cases, multiple solutions. Three, circumstances change when your stance changes. If we break down the word circumstance, the first part of it, circum, which is a circle, stance, which means to stand. Steve obviously did not stand. Oh, I got to add more time to the clock. Steve, obviously, he didn't stand still. He got into motion. As he stated, his circumstances didn't immediately change, but they changed when he changed, not only philosophy, but he weekends for 4 years, he was out on the road. And he still continued to do, his Monday through Friday Steve Harvey show. And the last thing, now there are other things that you can pick out of this. It might be different for everybody, but anyway. Count your blessings instead of your burdens. A lot of people who get stuck with a big challenge, they just start counting their burdens. I can't do this. I don't have this, that, or the other. But Steve Harvey, and I think Steve Harvey starts his day off with, he starts out early morning. He counts 70, I think, anywhere from 50 to 75 blessings. That's one of his daily, regimens or whatever. So, four things, problem versus the promise. That's all I got for today. Delmar, anything you wanted to add?
Thanks for sharing all that. That's beneficial. That's what I need to hear. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So tomorrow we will pick back up with our and there's one audio I've been looking forward to. I got it in I double checked. I got two copies of it in my audio library here, but for some reason, when it's showtime, it won't pop up. Well, maybe I need to delete some things. Anyway, on that note, everyone, hold it. Am I ready? Yeah. On that note, what time is it? 11:30, 10:30 Eastern Standard Time. I mean, oh, wait a minute. 11:30 Eastern Standard Time, where I am. Central Time is 10:30. On that note, see you guys tomorrow.